Hello, and welcome to episode 57 of the Sci-Fi Podcast. From Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Nick Zoutra. On today's podcast, I am pleased to welcome Dr. Julia Burstyn, assistant professor in the Department of Philosophy at the University of Kentucky. Julia's research is in the philosophy of nanoscience. Nanoscience is part chemistry, part physics, and part material science. It has grown up around the development of practical technologies aimed at solving extra-scientific problems, including medical imaging and the energy crisis. To solve these problems, nanoscientists are synthesizing new materials with never-before-seen properties, and they are using scientific models and theories in new ways to figure out how to manipulate and control these properties in new machines, devices, and medical therapies. As a philosopher of nanoscience, Julia examines the theories, models, reasoning strategies, and other conceptual tools that nanoscientists use to accomplish their goals, and studies how these conceptual tools can in turn reveal new information about the character of scientific knowledge. In addition to her work in nanoscience, Julia is working hard to contribute to a socially engaged philosophy of science with her recent organization of the inaugural Mid-South Philosophy of Science Conference. Work featured in this upcoming conference seeks to investigate the relationship between philosophy of science and the sciences that result from collaborations within the sciences, the role of science in broader social issues, and includes research that employs a regional focus, such as projects on the opioid epidemic or the role of coal in the energy crisis. Julia is also currently serving as the co-chair of the Philosophy of Science Association's Women's Caucus. Founded in November 2006, the goals of the caucus are to informally mentor women entering philosophy of science, to provide an opportunity for networking among the women of the Philosophy of Science Association, and to raise the visibility of women in the field, as well as to address any concerns about women and gender in the Philosophy of Science Association. And thus, without further ado, let's bring in Julia. So what were you interested in growing up? What was going on in Columbus, Ohio? What did you find yourself interested in?
Lots of horses. I was a horse kid. Yeah. I did 4-H. I took riding lessons starting when I was 8. I went to summer camp one year and fell in love with it and kind of never looked back and was in a fortunately positioned family where I was able to go do those things and spent basically all of my free time out at the barn.
That's really, yeah. So coming from Arizona, I was new to 4-H getting to Indiana. Not like I participated in it, but I would meet a lot of people from Indiana or meet people who have kids and they're like, oh yeah, we're getting our kids into 4-H. I'm like, what is this 4-H? And it's like this whole thing with animals, but it's also
it's like Girl Scouts for farm kids.
Okay.
Is a good way of thinking about it. But yeah, it's also, I mean, they do a lot of scholarship work. They integrate into communities. It's similar to a lot of the sort of Rotary and Elks kind of community engagement clubs, but for kids. And, the basic premise of 4-H, which, you know, I also, when I wasn't doing horses, I really liked school. I was into school and liked reading novels and things and lots of sci-fi. But 4-H for the participants is based around doing projects. So you get these sort of workbooks and it's like having extra recreational homework where you go through and carry a project to completion. And the project could be raising a lamb to take to the market. It could be showing a horse, which was one that I did a lot. It could be comparing, the classic like Napoleon Dynamite, comparing milk quality of different cows. I actually did a hay quality contest once. So like when Napoleon Dynamite came out, which was when I was in high school in my 4-H years, it really hit home.
Oh, I bet. They kind of put 4-H on the map nationally in terms of like This, yeah, I totally forget about that. That's what they were up to.
I can't remember if it was 4-H or FFA. I think it was FFA for them, which is
maybe like, that's the West version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you know, 4-H also has projects like I did a news reporting project. So I was very involved with my high school newspaper and did like a 4-H project for the newspaper on news reporting and also woodworking. And, you know, they like, you know, you compete with the projects, you fill out the workbook, you make a thing or do a thing and learn about how to do the thing with the workbook. And then there are ways of exhibiting the thing you've done, usually at county fairs. And then if you do well enough, you go to the state fair. And that's the basic mechanics of 4-H.
It sounds like a lot of fun. What did you feel like you kind of gained from it? What did you feel like you learned and or, I don't know, took away from it?
So for me, I joined my 4-H club when I moved from the first barn that I had been taking lessons at and where I had had been stabling my horse to a new barn. And I had moved at sort of a traumatic inflection point in my development and getting to the new barn and finding out that there was this sort of structured community of people who, you know, we met either once a week or once a month or however often you meet. And then, the other, kids who were around who were at the barn in the club, were just a lot friendlier and a lot easier to get along with. And part of it was because we had this sort of forced period of interaction.
Yeah.
And I actually met my best friend in the 4-H club. And, you know, she's someone like I was her maid of honor. She was my maid of honor.
Oh, wow.
Talk for an hour on the phone at least once a week today to this day, over half my life later. And I met her because I was the new kid in the 4-H club and she was the president of the 4-H club. And the advisor for the 4-H club said, "Hey, you're the president of the 4-H club. You have to go be nice to the new kid." Yeah, so I got my best friend out of it and a number of other things.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, so it sounds like, yeah, in addition to applying a lot of, you know, really, you know, great lessons in responsibility and other kinds of things, it provided some, you know, social support or just connection in general.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's wonderful. So in addition to 4-H, I guess I could say, growing up in Columbus, you know, was philosophy on the radar at all? Was this of interest to you, or what else did you find your time doing?
Yeah, it actually was. So I didn't really know what philosophy was. We certainly didn't have philosophy classes, but I knew that there were things called philosophers who wrote interesting stuff that I had read. Like I said, I liked school. I liked reading and writing. You know, if you want to go through like childhood career aspirations for most of my early childhood and through to sort of early adolescence, it was going to be a novelist and then it was going to be a horse trainer. So I read a lot and I encountered philosophers as I was reading, either people being mentioned or, you know, in high school English classes, reading things like Hesse and Camus, which are not the kinds of philosophy that I read today, but were things that were called philosophy and were interesting. And, you know, it's a bit embarrassing now to recognize that reading Zen and the Other Motorcycle Maintenance really made me be a philosopher, but at the time, it really made me want to be a philosopher.
This was mentioned, I think, by another philosopher recently who was...
Oh, really?
Yeah, who had read this. I forget who it was. No, and then they prefaced this with, like, "I'm embarrassed to admit," and it's like, oh, yeah. It's
bad philosophy and kind of sexist.
Oh, so I haven't read it, I have to be honest, but... Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's too late for you now.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so I knew what philosophy was, and... You know, I was around a bunch of professors' kids a lot in high school and their parents. And, you know, we had sort of a family friend who was a philosophy professor at Ohio State. And he gave me some really good advice when I was, when I had gotten into college and about to head out. And he told me, never, ever be a philosopher unless you can't do anything else, unless you literally cannot wake up, get through your day, do other things. And that really stuck with me. And so when I started college, was planning to double major in physics and philosophy. And I took a year off between high school and college. I graduated high school right after I turned 16 and wanted to take some time before I started college because being sort of socially younger than everyone else in my high school classes was difficult.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I was 2 years younger than everyone in my class.
Sure.
And it, you know, my parents sort of moved me up in classes, and by the time I was in middle school, they were involving me in the decision making for it. And I liked school and I got bored easily. And so I wanted to be in the more advanced classes. But, I think I became aware of the fact that I was at a sort of different level of social development, kind of as I was coming into middle school and high school.
Yeah.
Not in the way that I'm aware of it now, because looking back, I can see it very differently. But, you know, I was just not as interested in hanging out with my friends and much more interested in doing the school part of things. And so taking a year off between high school and college allowed me to sort of figure out who I was when I didn't have my nose in a book. So I took the year off. And then
how was that year, by the way, this sort of gap year and year of self-exploration?
I mean, it was great. It was boring. It taught me that I really wanted to go do school stuff, which by the time high school ended, I wasn't quite sure. That was when I was thinking, maybe I'll just go train horses.
That's right. Yeah.
And so I spent the year at the barn training, working, showing, riding, and working as a nanny for a family in town. And it made me really appreciate homework and what I had missed in school. It made me appreciate like having structured intellectual pursuits. And at the same time, like I had taken a year off from having classes, having homework. So I got to Rice where I did my undergrad and, was very excited to be back in classes and be back around people my age because I'm spending a lot of time with an 8-year-old boy who really just wanted to talk about hockey and the movie Elf.
Was this like who worked at the stables or like,
no, this is the kid that I was nannying for.
Oh, the nannying. Okay.
Yeah.
I had this image of a child at the stables. I don't know. Anyway.
There were plenty of those too.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah. But it turned out that like taking a year off from school made school harder to come back to. And I didn't have a whole lot of practice in doing homework for college level classes. So I enrolled in the honors calculus and the honors physics because I was really excited to be back and I wanted some actual hard, interesting material. And the physics class had the optional homework where you don't have to turn it in, but you're welcome to turn it in and they'll look at it if you do turn it in and give you feedback on it. And I took the optional to mean genuinely optional. And so then when it came to exam time, I had not done a whole lot of physics problems, and I got a 24% on my first physics exam.
Nice.
And then, sort of had a moment of like, okay, I got to figure out a new way of doing this. And the physics got better, but the math was bad. And it was bad in, like, I thought that I was bad at math for a while and kind of for the first time in my life because I had a really unpleasant classroom experience. And it all kind of came to a head when the professor was like came into class one day and passed out little pamphlets of the Gospel of Luke, which is
in math.
Bring it to in an honors calculus class. Yeah.
At Rice so, or is this in high school?
Rice.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's Texas. Yeah.
I mean, it was the only sort of bad professor experience I had at Rice actually. And the problem was in part that like this was a sort of beloved professor who'd been teaching at Rice for like 45 years. And so I never got along with him before this. And when this happened, I complained to the speaker for the faculty senate about it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Who, you know, like told the president and there was this whole kerfuffle and and then not only like I had already kind of felt like there was something wrong with me for not getting along with this professor because everyone else seemed to be really enjoying the way that he taught and I found it just maddening. And you know, then over and above this, I'm the one who like got this guy that everyone likes in trouble. And so, it became harder to take math classes. And so I stopped taking math classes for a while and, took on the philosophy major as my main plan for college.
All right. And so what did you find interesting about philosophy?
I fell in love with Leibniz first, and I loved that I could still think about a lot of the same cool sort of physics-y, math-y things that I wanted to think about and was having a hard time finding a way to pursue in my physics and math classes. And, I didn't know that philosophy of science was a thing for most of college. I found out sort of right before I started applying for grad school. But there were a lot of classes that I took at Rice that were about science without being regular everyday science classes. And I think the early experience in the physics and math classes during my first semester sort of turned me off from the standard science major progression. I was never not interested in thinking about science. And so, taking the class on Leibniz, there was a class in my first year still at Rice that was called Physics and the Fate of the World, which was all about the sort of revolutions in quantum mechanics and relativity that accompanied the First and Second World War and the interplay of the sociopolitical situation and the situation in theoretical physics. And that class was really powerful to me to think about, like, this is a way you can get to think about physics without having to put up with these giant lecture halls and sort of structures that didn't work well for me.
So it sounds to me like there's some kind of like the social and sort of just kind of interdisciplinary structure of physics and everything was a turnoff in terms of joining in the sort of more traditional science route.
Yeah, I mean, just the regular science major track I just couldn't figure out a way to make it work. And I think like I had a couple bad experiences very early on, and you know, maybe if I had stuck it out another semester, I wouldn't be talking to you right now and I'd be in a different department. But obviously I'm very glad that it worked out this way. And Rice had a ton of really interesting philosophy classes and a ton of other, so like, you know, I took this Physics and the Fate of the World class. There was also a Chemistry of Art class that was done in partnership with the Houston Museum of Art. And so we like got to go learn about the chemistry of restoring paintings and photography and those sorts of classes really grabbed my attention, and they were accompanied by a bunch of really intensive philosophy classes that I was taking.
All right. So what made the decision to, you've mentioned you found out about philosophy of science like just at the tail end of your studies. What was the critical, you know, how did you make that transition to saying, this is what I want to do?
Well, I was taking the shotgun approach to grad school, by which I mean, not like shotgun wedding, but like buckshot sort of like every, covers.
Different disciplines and stuff. Like, yeah. So what were you applying to?
It was basically all philosophy, but applied to like 13, 14 schools kind of across the board. And, there was a professor who was visiting Rice, I can't remember if it was my junior or senior year. I think it was my junior year, my third year. And he was a philosopher of physics who was working on some stuff that I now know to be like inter-theoretic relations in physics, which is still something that I'm very interested in. He offered to do an independent study with me, and I got to read a bunch of philosophy of physics and realized that a lot of the stuff that I liked in Leibniz and in the early moderns had to do with the interaction between the way they thought about epistemology and metaphysics and the way they thought about science. And so discovering that there were still people who did that and that that's what philosophy of science was made me want to pursue that. But at the point of applying to grad schools, I was still just, I wanted to go to philosophy grad school and kind of see what happened. And so my senior year, we actually hired a philosopher of science at Rice, Melinda Fagan, who she became my thesis advisor. She was actually an Indiana grad.
Right. Yeah. I think she was a student of Lisa Lloyd's, my advisor currently. Yeah.
And so she actually came to Rice, you know, for her job talk. And I started corresponding with her before she ever got to campus because I wanted to do a senior thesis in philosophy. And my department was saying, you need to be advised by a philosopher of science if you want to do a philosophy of science thesis. And so I got in touch with her, and I was actually driving from Columbus to see some family in Colorado over the summer between junior and senior year. Mm-hmm. And stopped in Bloomington and had my first thesis meeting with Melinda before she ever got on campus at Rice.
Oh, no way.
And she was a phenomenal thesis advisor. She was an incredibly devoted mentor. And, I certainly don't do philosophy of biology. My thesis was somewhat more biologically focused because she was advising it. But, she and I are still close colleagues to this day. She's actually, she wrote a piece for me in this edited volume that I'm putting together. That relationship really, really was the first sort of longstanding intellectual relationship that I have in philosophy of science, and one that still, I look forward to seeing her every time I get to see her.
That's great. That's terrific. So it turns out that you ended up at Pittsburgh. Is that right?
Yeah.
So for those of you who likely know or don't know, University of Pittsburgh has the Department of History and Philosophy of Science, as well as the Center for Philosophy of Science. How was your time there?
I really liked it. I didn't have a choice. Like I said, I took the sort of shotgun, let's apply to a bunch of places. And I got into one graduate school, and it was Pitt HPS.
Wow.
And it was the one that I was not expecting to get into.
For those of you who know, Pitt is a top five program. So it's a very, very good school.
Yeah. So I went because that was where I could go. And, I really fell in love with the city of Pittsburgh. I sort of had a similar struggle to the beginning of my undergraduate career, where I came in and wanted to do pretty hardcore philosophy of quantum mechanics type stuff, and ran up against trying to figure out how to teach myself the mathematics in order to do the quantum mechanics, in order to do the philosophy.
Oh, geez, yeah.
And, you know, at that point, was still trying to deal with, you know, believing that I was bad at math and to like get through a lot of that. And it wasn't until my third year of graduate school when the philosophy department actually hired Bob Batterman, and I started taking classes with him and seeing the way that he thought through the importance of explaining how the scientific example works that you're presenting in your bit of philosophy of science, that really made me rethink how I was doing, how I was approaching the kind of work that I wanted to do. And I ended up doing my dissertation with Bob, and Bob was extremely supportive of me pursuing the science that I wanted to do, which turned out not to be quantum mechanics. You know,
Interesting enough, like you've done, it sounds, it's, sorry for telling your story. I see that you're a philosopher of nanoscience.
Yes.
So could you tell us a little bit about nanoscience and how that transition from physics to nanoscience came about?
Yeah. So I have always found chemistry to be very sort of understandable and organized, and it's a, like a lot of little twiddly puzzles that are easy to solve. I like physics better most of the time. but there's something that's very sort of straightforward to me about chemistry, and it probably has to do with the fact that my parents met in grad school for chemistry, and there was just chemistry around me all the time growing up.
Were so both your parents professors?
No, my dad was. My mom actually was an industry chemist for a number of years, and then when I was three, changed careers and went to med school and was a doctor.
Okay.
So I had a lot of chemistry just sort of in my DNA, I suppose, and liked the quantum mechanics because it felt very pristine and easy in a way like chemistry is often sloppy. And there's also just not as much philosophy of chemistry out there. And it took a while before anyone ever, you know, I don't know if anyone showed me or if I found it or what, but to sort of come around to the idea that philosophy of chemistry was a thing you could do. That happened significantly after discovering the philosophy of science was a thing you could do. And so one of the great things about Pitt and especially about working with Bob was that, you know, they encourage you to go take science classes, get interested in the science, find a piece of science. You know, Bob's advice is always like, find a piece of science that is cool and the philosophy will follow. And so I started taking some chemistry classes at Pitt and took an inorganic chemistry class, which I really liked because inorganic is makes use of a lot of the same principles of quantum, of sort of symmetry groups and you know, organizing information in like matrices that are encoded in very pretty and like intellectually satisfying ways. But it's stuff that you can like touch and see at the end, right? Like minerals and crystals. And then after that, the university had hired a new chemist who was doing nanoscience, and I went to visit her. I've actually never noticed this before. I've like caught three people who have been very important to my intellectual development right as they move to a university that I'm already at.
Just something, I don't know.
I never noticed that before. That's funny. So this chemist, Jill Millstone, moved to Pitt to start her career there and was teaching a class called Atoms, Molecules, and Materials. And I like all of those things. So I figured I would ask if I could take the class. And she had me come in before class and meet with her and explain why a philosopher would want to be taking a chemistry class. And we hit it off immediately and had this sort of like lovely flowing, spiraling intellectual conversation about the history of philosophy of science. And, you know, she was an English and chemistry major as an undergrad at Carnegie Mellon. And so we just hit it off immediately and I took her class. And, originally the nano stuff was supposed to be just like one back end chapter of my dissertation. And as soon as I started working with her and, doing the research a little more in depth, it quickly became the entire dissertation and the focus of my career so far.
So what are the big philosophical questions in nanoscience? And how do they build off from your interest in the philosophy of chemistry?
So the big questions in nano have to do with what happens both to materials and to our models and theories about those materials as we enter a new scale of matter, right? So nano is the scale where chemical bonds happen. I mean, it's actually one scale above the sort of angstrom. We created the angstrom length scale, which is 10 to the minus 10th meters, in order to measure the distance of small bonds. But for larger materials, at the nanoscale, it's 10 to the minus 9th meters, one order of magnitude higher. The cool thing about it is that it's where chemical bonds are happening, but it's also where you're getting stuff that has material looking construction, insides and outsides and halves and corners. And so the sort of theoretical way of saying it is it's right at the classical quantum interface. And there are parts of the system that are dominated by behavior at the classical scale and parts of the system that are dominated by quantum behavior. And trying to reconcile the two is a really hard problem that is a very practical problem. It's not the sort of, you know, the intellectual problem of intertheoretic reduction, which is like, at the end of science, is it all going to be this sort of grand unified theory where we just plug in our you know, our boundary and initial conditions, and then the laws tell us the entire configuration of the universe.
Sure.
Which, like, of course it's not. We'll talk about that if you want to, but
no,
it's a very strong case against that.
Yeah.
But it's also like, this is not like a sort of reflective intellectual puzzle of grand unified theories. It's a very practical problem that has to be solved in order to make the materials that make the displays in our cell phones. And that, you know, give us better chemotherapy delivery and give us better solar cells. And you know, nano is this sort of universal flexible technology that it, especially when it was sort of having its heyday, which it's, we're about 10 years, maybe 15 years past its sort of big first push heyday, but it was this sort of savior technology of like, we're going to solve all of the problems that we're having. We're going to solve the energy crisis and the cancer crisis. And we're going to get people clean water and we're going to get better cell phones and all like all of that was supposed to happen through nano. And a lot of that has like nano has played a role in a lot of it. But it's, you know, it's the fact that this set of puzzles that I've cared about for a while, the inter-theoretic relations puzzles, which is a philosopher of chemistry you care about because chemistry is the first thing that gets reduced to physics. It's the first thing that gets sort of like shunted off into that's just complicated. And as someone who likes chemistry, I've always worried about that characterization of it. And so that set of puzzles, which, you know, it's such a classic topic in philosophy of science of inter-theoretic relations and reduction and emergence, became an extremely practical set of problems to solve at the nanoscale.
So what kinds of questions did you go about attempting to address?
So I started with just trying to understand one part of nanomaterials. And it's a very complicated part, and it's a part that I'm still trying to understand. I thought that I would kind of get through it in one chapter of the dissertation and be done with it.
Yeah.
And it's turned into something that I still like the chapter of the dissertation became the article, became the other article. I'm still sort of struggling through and writing through and haven't quite figured out how I want to say everything I want to say about it. But the part is the surface. So the surface of nanomaterials are so monstrously different from the surface of macroscopic materials that it's in some senses very bizarre that we even call them surfaces at all.
Really?
And yet, yeah, because surfaces of macroscopic materials, I mean, they're tiny, they're negligible, they're effectively infinitesimal proportions of the material. Like even for something as small as a human hair, if you were to like cut a cross section on the human hair, the percent of atoms in that hair that are on the surface of the hair is like way less than 0.5%, right? I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I actually sat down and did the calculations once based on the sort of protein structure of hair, and it's teeny tiny. And at the nanoscale, you know, your surfaces are 10 or 20 or 40 or sometimes 100% of the material. And yet there's still a surface and an inside, which makes them different from molecules. Molecules don't really have the kinds of things that we would call a material surface. And so I just find the situation for surfaces utterly compelling because I think it poses a set of practical modeling challenges. It also poses a really deep conceptual challenge about what it is that we mean by surface at the nanoscale. And I don't think we have the tools yet in philosophy of science to explain how that happens to surfaces at the nanoscale and to the models that we have for the surfaces. And I think that understanding how that shift occurs at the nanoscale is actually a pretty crucial part of understanding how nanoscience develops and how other sciences that confront sort of conceptual revolutions in this way have developed as well.
So you mentioned, beginning to work with Robert Batterman and a number of other chemists. Could you go perhaps describe a little bit about your process of interaction and engagement with these other folks and what you learned in terms of addressing or how to go about addressing these particularly really interesting problems, particularly problems related to the surface, by engagement with chemists, engagement with these philosophers who had a certain thing to say about how to go about learning and applying philosophy or finding the philosophy in the science?
Yeah. So it might help to preface by saying I'm somewhat unusual for a philosopher in that I'm an extrovert. Philosophy is a discipline that attracts introverts, that is, you know, except at the job market stage where it's really nice to be an extrovert.
Right.
In terms of faculty development and the things you have to do as a philosopher to get research done, it's a lot easier for introverts. I really think best when I'm talking to someone and when I'm sort of
same with
working,
me. Yeah.
Yeah. When I'm like working a problem out loud. I mean, we actually saw it earlier in this interview where I had this sort of realization of like, oh, I've like caught these three people at this like inflection point in their in their career trajectories that have become inflection points in mine. And so anyway, so I'm an extrovert and I like talking to people, and I was taking this class with Dr. Millstone with Jill and I would come talk to her after class about questions that I had about how the chemistry was going and then kind of relating it back to the kinds of stuff that I cared about intertheoretic relations and about scientific explanation. And Jill really liked those questions. And when the class ended, I went to meet with her to figure out, I wanted to ask her to join my dissertation committee and see if there were, you know, ways that we could keep working together. And she invited me to join her lab group. And so at that point, I started going to her group meetings every week. And I went every week for I want to say 4 or 5 years. And so group meetings are something that are very common in the sciences and very uncommon in philosophy. So what they look like is a bunch of people sitting around a conference table, and one person presents work that they've been doing, and it's sort of on a rotation of the students. Mm-hmm. So it looks kind of like a philosophy seminar, except that you're not reading a thing together beforehand. You're presenting right. on research that you're doing. Jill actually, after a semester or so, threw me into the rotation. So I would start presenting on either, you know, teaching them a little bit of basics of philosophy of science, or on, you know, research questions that I was working on that had to do with the research they were doing. But I got a lot of it by osmosis, I suppose, just by mm-hmm. sitting in the room with them and asking questions. So like even the surfaces stuff came up because I caught one of her students explaining how a dangling bond was affecting surface curvature or something like that. That wasn't exactly the example, but
sure.
The dangling bond model of surfaces relies on an atomic model of surfaces where you're treating the surface as like a bunch of little balls that are stuck together in a lattice. And surface curvature comes from a continuous model of surfaces where you treat the surface as, you know, atomically smooth. And these are fundamentally incompatible views of what the surface is. And of course, we know that the surface is made of atoms, but it's often more effective to use continuum models. And that's, you know, that's something that Bob Batterman's career has focused on, and which I think he's done really well, is like talk about the utility of models that we think are, strictly speaking, false of the world, and why those models are nonetheless often true of the materials that they're describing. But this was a slightly different kind of situation where it wasn't just like effective use of false models. It was using two conflicting models to describe one situation, right? Two models that say conflicting things about the world to describe a particular research situation. And so it was going through that example with the student and then finding other areas where that happened again and again and again and again in nano that made me really want to pursue the philosophical puzzles in nanoscience in more detail.
Yeah. Wow. That's fascinating. It's true in terms of this is a different kind of way of doing philosophy of science or philosophy generally. I think philosophy of science is a little bit more connection with the kind of social extroversion that you're describing, but not necessarily. So tell us a little bit about your position at Kentucky since 2016 the research program with which you're developing there.
Yeah, so I got here in fall of 2016, as you said, and was immediately contacted by the biology department of all places, and in a sort of unusual way. They had been in contact with another would-be faculty member who had accepted a position at Kentucky and ended up deferring the position and then not coming ultimately. But they had been in contact with him as a philosopher of science about co-teaching a philosophy or a science and religion class, excuse me. Hmm. And this, you know, this was sort of in my first few months at Kentucky when I was still getting settled and trying to figure out where the good coffee was. And was a real welcome sort of moment of interaction with the natural sciences. And so I went and met with the folks over in biology and ended up co-teaching a class with a professor in biology and his graduate student, whose class development it was. Like, she had come up with this idea of a science and religion class. And we taught it in my second semester here, and then we taught it again in the fall. This time I was the primary instructor for it, and it gave me a lot of chance to interact both with the biology department, but then also with the sort of greater community in Lexington, and to learn a little bit about how Lexington and how Kentucky deal with issues at the intersection of science and faith, which is certainly not the sort of stuff that I was spending my time on in grad school. But
right.
one of the things that we didn't really touch on when we were talking about fit at the beginning was feeling like the work makes a difference. And at Kentucky, I really feel like the work makes a difference. And like, as an extrovert, I'm good at teaching. I like the teaching. Yeah. I get a lot of energy from teaching and teaching the science and religion, and then also teaching, they have a sort of standard healthcare ethics, medical ethics kind of class that they have to have taught. And again, I'm not a bioethicist, but we have a very pluralistic department here, which is awesome. Like, we have people who are doing very Marxian political philosophy. We have people who are sort of continental historians of Kant. We have a historic strength in history of philosophy that's carried forward. And there are all of these people who are doing all kinds of things that are even farther from healthcare ethics than what I do. So yeah. I started teaching healthcare ethics and ended up teaching it each of my first three semesters here. And I'm teaching it again this semester, and it's really become a kind of bread and butter class for me that I love, because I get a lot of science students. I've actually had a number of them become philosophy minors and a few become majors now because of the class, and which, you know, it lets me interact with people who care about science by teaching them philosophy, which is a lot of what I did in the lab with my chemists. And you know, it's also talking about healthcare ethics in Kentucky is important work in a way that, I mean, not just in Kentucky, anywhere, but we're one of the sort of three or four biggest states for the opioid crisis. And, we're still dealing with coal-related health issues all the time. Kentucky still has a huge history of tobacco use. And I actually just learned from a neurologist who wants to develop a philosophy of neuroscience class with us that Kentucky has almost double the rate of epilepsy of some states, and no one knows why. And that's a really cool and exciting problem to have. So, you know, Kentucky has been a really welcoming intellectual community. And I think that, you know, the contact with the biologists was the first sort of outreach that I had with scientists. But even in my interview here, I met with folks in the chemistry department, and I've been invited to give, you know, sort of their weekly seminars in the materials engineering department and the chemistry department and the physics department. And there's a lot of contact with research active scientists here, which is exactly the kind of thing you get at these big land grant flagship schools. And it's, you know, it's really inspiring, both for thinking about how I fit in as a member of this community, but then also thinking about where my research is going to go. I really like drawing from the folks around me for that, as I suppose a lot of our earlier stories have illustrated.
So this is actually kind of serendipitous. I did not make this connection before, but I was just yesterday filling out an abstract for this conference called MSPS 2019, Socially Engaged Philosophy of Science in the Middle States. And that's so, and then as you're talking about all this stuff, and it's like, it's at the University of Kentucky, and then I look up and it's like contact. I was like, I wonder if, and I'm like, of course you're connected with this. So let's, so this is a really cool opportunity. This was like posted to me or shared with me on Twitter, like, oh, this is, I forget who did it, but they CC'd me and said like, this would be interesting. You should, you know, apply, or you should consider this. This looks like a really cool and interesting collection of folks, and just an interesting thing. So can you tell us a little bit about this conference, what it's about? Obviously the abstracts are closed for submission, but you know, what you hope to hope to achieve by this meeting?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I'm going to tell you the long version of the story, is that I went to grad school in history and philosophy of science department, 30, you know, eager students around me at all times doing philosophy of science.
Yep.
Moving away from that community into a place where you're sort of the philosopher of science at the university and everyone else is doing other things was, I didn't realize, again, as an extrovert, as someone who sort of like draws from the air around me, I didn't realize how big of a difference that was going to be in the way that I approached research and sort of did my everyday work. And so in my second year, or I guess it was the end of my first year at Kentucky, you know, you get these sort of calls for proposals and grants and things. And one came across my desk that was, hey, we have some limited research funds for folks who don't normally seek external funding. And like the whole call for it is, if you're not used to getting external funding, if you're not sort of in the standard grant cycle, we want to give you funds to just go do something weird and cool.
Yeah.
And so I was sitting around thinking like, hey, it would be great if I had other philosophers of science around me to talk to. And then got this email and said, I'm going to write a grant to go find other philosophers of science around me to talk to. So I literally, like, I wrote up a grant that was like, I want gas money to drive around Kentucky and find other people who are working in philosophy of science, buy them lunch. And that's what I did. And, you know, there are, I was really surprised in my first year here to discover that both Sandra Harding and Helen Longino were like, happened to be giving talks at, one was at the University of Kentucky and one was down at Center College, which is a small liberal arts college, maybe 45 minutes from Lexington. And I almost missed both of them because I didn't hear about them until 24 hours ahead of time. And I wanted to make sure that I didn't miss anything in the future. So I started looking around to see, you know, who was inviting those people to give these talks and who's kind of around and thinking about philosophy of science. And it turned out that, you know, there was a woman, Vanessa Bentley, who was working at Center, who did a lot of philosophy of neuroscience. There was a woman at Moorhead, Christina Conroy, who's a, you know, a metaphysician and philosopher of physics. There was a guy doing sort of analytic philosophy of language, but with some sort of interesting science connections down at Western Kentucky University, which is all the way down in Bowling Green. And then of course there are some folks doing really great stuff in, you know, if you sort of widen the base to a couple more hours out, it includes Indiana, as you know, as well as Ohio State and University of Tennessee. And so I had this idea that, like, you know, there's a little bit of a nexus here. We might be able to get something going. And so with the first grant, I drove around. I had lunch with all of these people. I invited them to campus in Lexington. It's something you can drive in a day and come back for all of them. Oh, and I forgot, there's a great feminist bioethicist at University of Louisville who's been really involved as well, Lauren Freeman. And so got all of them to come to Lexington for a day-long workshop where we did a sort of introduction to each other. We all did little research presentations on what we're working on to let each other know how we think about things, and then made plans to have a conference and to start we're calling it a network, the Mid-South Philosophy of Science Network. And, you know, this was the first funding cycle, and then got renewed for the second funding cycle to do this conference. And we are, you know, we're doing a 2-day conference, but it's also meant to be, in a similar way, a way of sort of uniting and networking the folks who are working in areas of the country that often get flown over or that don't have, you know, historically don't have as much research funding available for philosophical research. And you know, I've gotten nothing but positive feedback from it so far. As you said, the abstracts closed last night. I was nervous that no one would apply.
Sure. Is this the first first version of this?
It's the first open call conference that we're having. We did the workshop, but that was just people who had already been sort of identified and who I'd talked to previously. And we now have the like wonderful situation of having more applications than we have time for.
Perfect.
And I'm going to be meeting with the other organizers, Christina Conroy, who's the philosopher of physics at Morehead State. And then Ian Muntean is a philosopher of physics primarily, who's working at in a number of schools in the sort of Asheville, North Carolina mountains area. So it's funny that it's organized by three philosophers of physics, because the goal of the conference and of the network more broadly is not to do philosophy of physics. I mean, we won't avoid philosophy of physics, but there's a big social engagement undercurrent in it, and a regional social engagement undercurrent in the network as well, which has to do with the fact that like there are, like I was mentioning earlier, I got to Kentucky, there are interesting problems to solve that we might be able to help with. So things like the opioid crisis, like renewing disenfranchised coal communities, like trying to figure out, you know, this is the state of Mitch McConnell. This is a state that has some significant political polarization. I think that there are things that philosophy of science can help with that we're not helping with. And I'd like to find ways of encouraging people to do more of that kind of work. So not just social engagement with scientists, although I think that's important too, but social engagement with a region, with the actual location that you're in. And that's why I'm so excited that we have Sean Bias as our keynote, because he's, you know, I think he's someone who's doing that really well.
Yeah, and we see scientists pretty engaged with the region, not always, but often engaged with the region with which they live, making some kind of connection or adopting some kind of distinguished part. Oh, Sean Bias, he's also an Indiana grad. I forget about that. I think I meant it. cool. It sounds like a great conference. I hope you've got, you know, have a number of great abstracts with which to choose. And, you know, if not this year, I'm excited to attend or at least participate and recommend it. I actually recommended this conference to my graduate cohort, but we're also having our own graduate conference during this time.
It's
one of those
things.
There's
no good time to have a conference.
But I
hope that some of you will get in the car and come over.
I told him, like, we can do both. We can just, you know, it's Friday, come one day, go to the next day. We're not too far away.
We'll be happy to put you in touch with our graduate students who are used to putting up folks for the night. So.
It's a wonderful time. So, I mean, if you kind of described a little bit, but maybe in a few sentences, what do you think? How can philosophy of science be used to address these pressing social problems?
So I think it's important to remember our roots. And maybe I'm only thinking about this because I taught a lecture in the Vienna Circle yesterday, but the Vienna Circle was scientists, and they were scientists who were pretty politically and socially engaged, and they started reading philosophy, and we don't have as many scientists reading philosophy as we used to, I think. And of course, you know, there are good sort of incentive structure and institutional explanations for why not. And we have philosophers of science who are doing research on those institutional infrastructure questions. But I think getting scientists excited about philosophy of science and then getting communities excited about philosophy of science as a means of thinking through problems critically and addressing especially some of the issues of values and objectivity in science in more responsible and nuanced ways than either science is always right and that's the end of it, or you know, this increasing anti-intellectualist, anti-science rhetoric that we've seen come out of the sort of present political moment of, you know, don't bring your science at me and try and change my beliefs with your science. I think that philosophy of science has done a better job of figuring out the value structure that is embedded within science and the both the limits of that, the recognition of that for, you know, what we can expect of science, but then also not just stopping there with the negative and instead saying, like, this is how science survives through that, and this is how we can, you know, how we can see objectivity as intersubjectivity, for instance, as a hopeful message, as a way that, you know, as a way of explaining a really strange and sort of miraculously effective part of the human endeavor, without either putting it on a pedestal to the extent that I think some of our, like, I do think, like, the sort of pedestal of expertise is, you know, we know that's a logical fallacy just as much as anything else. And, you know, asking people not to trust science because it's science, but to trust science because you understand how science works and also understand what the limits of science are. I think that's something that philosophers of science might be uniquely positioned to do. And, you know, it's not like we're going to be out there on, like, MSNBC or whatever, but, again, by having a sort of regional community oriented focus, thinking about, you know, how are people making political choices on the basis of, scientific evidence about coal runoff, about the opioid crisis, about, we have a crazy, lack of dentists in Kentucky. 40% of our dentists are in two of our 120 counties. Of course, you know, they're the counties that Lexington and Louisville are in. But thinking about inequities and distribution in that way is something that philosophers of science are well trained at, and translating that into what I take to be ultimately hopeful messages about the shift from thinking of science as the sort of standard old school realist reductionist science is the set of true facts that are out there story to the, you know, the practice turn, which has taken really strong hold in philosophy of science. If we can move that view of science out into the world, I actually think it could help to solve some of the problems that we're having with science's communication and reputation, especially in the U.S. today.
So this might be a continuation of what you were already explaining and just a reframing of it. But what do you take to be the greatest challenge facing philosophy of science today?
It's figuring out how to do that, how to get philosophers of science. And I think this is actually a really, it's a big challenge to us on an institutional level. To change the incentive structure of philosophy of science so that that work isn't the reward for having done a research career that is very sort of inwardly focused on responding to other philosophers of science. So, I think Heather Douglas is someone who has done a really good job of this throughout her career. She's always been engaged with, community interests and has been doing outward looking stuff on science and values. She now at the last Philosophy of Science biennial meeting gave this sort of large public lecture at a library, which is the sort of thing that I think we need to be doing more of. But I think this is a real challenge because you want the people who are the big names going out there representing you. You want the people who know how to talk about philosophy of science, who you trust to say good things about philosophy of science, out there representing what philosophy of science is to the public. But then doing that becomes a sort of extracurricular activity for all of us. And it's something that you get to do as a reward for having another career before it. And that you aren't particularly incentivized to do unless, you know, you're someone who likes the attention.
And then it's sometimes criticized as like, whatever, sure, self-promoting or something. I mean, some of this community-based stuff, I doubt that. But like even sometimes just media appearance or public engagement is not, it's not valued very much in the community or not.
Yeah.
It hasn't been historically.
I think it is valued in the sense of people recognize that it's an important thing to do. But you asked what the biggest challenge is. And I think the biggest challenge is taking that recognition and turning it into part of the infrastructure of philosophy of science. Which, I mean, it is in our roots, right? It was scientists who started this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And it was scientists who were not just talking to each other. They were talking to their colleagues. They were, you know, going out and trying to change the way that people were thinking about science, at least on their campuses. And, you know, I think the sort of impact of the Vienna Circle as a more broad intellectual force is something that we sometimes forget because it's our thing, but you know, it's out there and it has echoes and ripples or whatever sort of wave based metaphor you want. And I think we need to find a way to incentivize that and to institutionalize it.
I think that's a really good metaphor and our model to point back toward. And it's a telling model for philosophers of science who might be on the fence in terms of this. I was just having a conversation with a colleague yesterday in terms of this kind of social engagement and also trying to come up with responses toward what may, I don't know, have you come across or have you been able to respond to any potential criticisms to these suggestions that you're making, you know, of social engagement, of incentivizing, of building this stuff into the infrastructure? Certainly not everybody would agree.
You know, I haven't run into like overt criticism of, oh, we shouldn't be doing that, but it has affected my career. So let's talk about the surfaces stuff again that I walked you through. I still think that's the best philosophy that I've done so far in my career.
Yeah.
And it's been published in Nature Nano. And it's been published in the Journal of Physical Chemistry Letters. And I cannot get it published in philosophy journals. And it keeps coming back as, you know, this, you know, it's an interesting example and we can't quite figure out what the philosophical argument is. And that's like, that's reasonable.
Sure.
Like because of the way that we've set up what our sort of criteria of evaluation, what our merit structure is for evaluating philosophy of science articles, like I'm not framing it within a sort of standard dialectic structure of here's our problem for inter-theory relations and here's the like new example that I'm going to use to solve it. I may end up doing that to get it published because I do want it out there to our community. But you know, I think it has a material impact on my career so far, and like luckily my department is extremely supportive of me and doesn't care where I publish. So like they're going to count those publications in the science journals just as much as they're going to count.
Nature is a pretty big journal. So I would be, but I understand. I understand.
I mean, it's a 400 word thing about what, you know, what we can do when we think appropriately about nanoscience and how we need to, you know, revise our conceptual interests in order to make progress sometimes. And it's the most impactful thing I've ever written.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Which is, you know, it's fine. It's nice that it's out there. But I would also like my community to
recognize
to have that available to them as well. So.
No, I think I remember hearing a few years ago, someone discuss like doing philosophy of chemistry is difficult. At least in terms of getting it received, or is just there's just a smaller sense of the community. Probably, do you think maybe is it similar to like maybe I've heard that like doing philosophy of biology was pretty tough back in the 80s. People disliked and or thought the only game in town was philosophy of physics. But
yeah,
things are changing.
I'm not enough of a historian of philosophy of science to know that well. Figure. You could probably ask your advisor about it, and she would have a much better sense.
This comes from my own conversations with folks who were just they've worked through the trenches of this kind of criticism related to their not being as receptive to this other philosophical work, and it took a long time, or it took more time for people to see the importance and understand and
So, I mean, I think, you know, philosophy of chemistry is very small, and it stayed small the whole, I've now been in the field more or less. I've been doing philosophy of science in some capacity for a decade. It certainly hasn't grown since I've been here. Whereas like even since I started, things like philosophy of neuroscience have really taken off.
Right.
And you know, that's like the new hotness in town. And, I'm excited. Like I said, we had a neurologist in the med school, contact us, a philosopher of mind in my department and I, and he wants to, you know, develop a class and co-teach a class with all of us, which is going to be great.
Sure.
And I'm excited for the opportunity to learn some new science in that too. But the, you know, people have been trying to figure out the problem with philosophy of chemistry, at least as long as I've been doing this. And, you know, if you read the articles for certainly many years before that as well.
Yeah.
And I think there's a sort of unfortunate history with the philosophy of chemistry, which is that it was very easy as someone who knew chemistry to latch on to Putnam's meaning of meaning and the microessentialist view of natural kinds and say there are really good chemical reasons for doubting the story that Kripke and Putnam are telling us. And that's like that's a really fun thing to do as a chemist because you get to explain some chemistry. It has a direct and immediate impact on not just philosophy of science, but philosophy of language, metaphysics, depending on how you conceive metaphysics. But the problem is it actually kind of bypasses philosophy of science, and it's like chemistry correcting philosophy of language, which is where a lot of sort of early philosophy of chemistry started. And then there's also the sort of questions of the metaphysics of chemical bonds and are chemical bonds real and do we care whether or not they're actual things out there? Because of course, you know, it's an electron interaction, right? Yep. It's a quantum phenomenon, that you can measure by electrical potentials. But we model them with balls and sticks. And is it interesting that we have these things that we're sort of calling objects that are really just measures of electron interaction? And I don't think that that's interestingly different from questions of like, well, we talk about electric flow, right? We use sort of like hydrodynamic analogies to model that. And like, those are all kind of interesting questions in the sort of models and theories realm of philosophy of science about why those sorts of analogies and metaphors work. You know, there's a question that I've heard a number of philosophers of chemistry ask each other and critics of the kind of very idea of philosophy of chemistry ask of philosophers of chemistry, at least of me, is like, what are the native problems in chemistry that are of philosophical interest? And I've had that question asked to me a lot, and I've actually come around to the idea that that is a bad question to be asking. In part because if you think about the native questions that are of interest in any of the other sciences, yeah, they're some of the questions we ask in philosophy of science. Like, you know, what's the appropriate interpretation of quantum mechanics? How do we solve the levels of selection debate? But they're often kind of sophomoric topics, at least, you know, when they're presented in that way.
Mm.
And, you know, I think we're seeing in my sort of generation of philosophy of science and after the big, you know, the practice turn happened before I got here, right?
Yep.
That's something that a lot of folks who are in their sort of mid to late career now were really instrumental in pulling around. But now my generation, your generation, we're sort of the same intellectual generation here. We just get to be in it, right? It's already happened. And one of the things that's come out of that is less of an emphasis on like which kind of science, which science department are you most closely interested in, and just letting people think interesting things about particular pieces of science.
Yeah.
as part of what I love about the nano is I get to do physics, I get to do chemistry, I get to do material science, I get to do engineering.
Yeah.
I think that we're only going to see more and more of that. Fewer people identifying as a philosopher of biology, because even folks like, I think about Michael Weisberg, who's, mm-hmm. made his name as a philosopher of chemistry and now does, moved into sort of biological stuff for a little while.
Oh, I didn't realize he did chemistry. I didn't really.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, some of his early work was on conceptions of the bond. And that's where he started. And he's still, we have philosophy of chemistry interest group meetups every now and then. And he's often an organizing force with those. But, he's known much more broadly for doing stuff in models and stuff in biology and stuff kind of across the board. And I just think we're going to see more and more of that. And it's going to become less of a question of as a philosopher, you're not going to have to defend a whole discipline's philosophical interest. You're just going to have your interesting scientific puzzles and be able to explain how those influence our epistemology of science, or our ethics of science. I think that's a better way forward, and it's a way that's already starting, that you and I and other folks who are in our career stage are just going to reap the benefits of.
Yeah. Very well said. Well, Julia, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. We're about to the end of the hour or so. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with? Any last parting thoughts or plugs for different things? Anything you'd like to say?
Well, I will say, I'm a little surprised, I guess. Well, this is not going to be an easier, quick transition. We never talked about my work in the Women's Caucus, which,
let's talk about that. We don't need to.
I don't really know how it would sort of like plug in with the flow of the rest of things. And I don't want it to be like, oh yeah, also women at the end.
No, this is an ignorance on my part. I recall, and now this is something that I had in my notes actually to bring up. Let's talk a little bit about the recent Philosophy of Science Women's Caucus. Tell us a little bit about your work and progress in it.
Yeah, so the work that I've done with the Women's Caucus is actually some of the work that I'm proudest of, and that I think is going to have a lasting impact in certain ways. I just finished a 4-year term as one of the two co-chairs of the Women's Caucus. And I started going to meetings of the Women's Caucus in 2008 when I went to my first PSA meeting in Pittsburgh. And when I went there in 2008, there were maybe 20 or 30 people in the room, and we were sort of sitting around and, having a moment to catch our breaths, and say hello to each other outside of the bathrooms, which is really one of the only other places you find a lot of women at PSA conferences back in 2008. And, now, the most recent Women's Caucus, so since 2008, registration at the PSA meetings has doubled, and attendance at caucus meetings has gone up fivefold. So we are growing faster than the PSA, which is also growing. And it has been really transformative to me to play an active role in making philosophy of science a discipline that is welcoming to women, that is supportive both of women's work generally in philosophy of science, but also of feminist philosophy of science. And we can actually see changes on the PSA program. There was hardly any feminist philosophy of science that was happening in 2008, and there is more now. It's not its own category like philosophy of biology or anything, but we're seeing more and more of it, and it's becoming much more mainstream. And I do think that the Women's Caucus has played some role in that, whether it's, a sort of tertiary role of allowing folks to meet other folks who are doing feminist philosophy of science and get acknowledged for their work in our prize system, where we give a feminist philosophy of science prize every year. But we've also, in the 4 years that I was there, we started a number of new endeavors that I think do make a more sort of material difference to the experience of being at the PSA meeting. So,
yeah,
you know, we have a symposium that is the Women's Caucus Symposium now, where we have our own review structure that acknowledges a symposium that engages with work done by women, work done about issues of interest to the Women's Caucus, work done in the feminist philosophy of science tradition, any sort of combination of those. And we've had two of those symposia now at the 2016 and 2018 meetings. And they've been really well attended, really interesting. Our first one in 2016 was on animal cognition. Mm-hmm. And the one this time around was on climate change. And these are, you know, I think they're really sort of leading edge type topics. And, you know, it sort of ties in with some of the other stuff we were talking about with the you know, where I see philosophy of science going, where I see some of our challenges. The Women's Caucus Symposia in both cases have been ones where you're seeing really highly socially engaged work. You're seeing work that is often done in concert with scientists. And, you know, for whatever reason, the criteria that we have for selecting our symposia have turned up with really, I think, forward-looking and engaged symposia. And I don't think that's just a matter of putting women in the room, but I don't think it hurts. And so more generally, like, working with the Women's Caucus has turned me into something of an advocate for women in philosophy of science, which, you know, I've always been a feminist, but I was always a feminist independently of being the a philosopher.
Right.
And seeing those two come together and getting to play a role in making them come together has been a really important part of my career so far.
So how have you brought these two together? How have you seen from being a philosopher, a feminist kind of separately from the discipline, how has that translated into your work or into your work in the Women's Caucus?
Yeah. So I'm a philosopher of physics, and, you know, physics and chemistry and nanoscience, hardy sciences, as they sometimes say, sciences that don't directly confront issues of gender. And I was actually struggling with this as I was leaving my position as one of the co-chairs of the caucus, thinking about, you know, I've learned so much from my work with the caucus about feminist philosophy of science. It comes into my classroom all the time now. I teach a lot more science and values than I used to. I care a lot more about science and values than I used to. And a lot of that has come from being involved with the caucus. And so as I was leaving, and, you know, I'm in my third year, I'm up for a third year review and sort of thinking about where, you know, where I'm going. I have a roadmap for where I'm going until tenure, but then what happens after tenure? Do I want to stay doing work in the physical sciences or do I want to go do other work? And in talking to a number of colleagues and friends about this, this sort of struggle of like, I care a lot about feminist philosophy of science. I care a lot about feminism. I care a lot about women in the field. Does it need to show up in my research? Does it feel sort of intellectually dishonest not to? I actually came around to the realization that I want to keep doing philosophy of physics and I want to make it okay for women to just do work that they care about and not have to do work on being a woman in philosophy. Not that that's not something we can do and not that that's not something that I might do down the line, but, you know, there are so many good researchers who are doing stuff from the social sciences about women in our field, women in science, and from a biological standpoint, looking at biology and gender kind of stuff. And I got a little caught up as I was leaving the post of like, should I be doing that work? That work is really inspirational to me. And, you know, I've spent a fair amount of time over the past couple months thinking about it. and realizing that actually what I want to do is just keep doing the physical sciences stuff that I liked to make it okay for the next generation of women to just be women who are doing philosophy of science and let that be enough and not have to sort of do philosophy of science about women just in order to be in the field. Although I still might want to do some of that stuff later.
Yeah,
but I want that to be okay too.
I completely hear you and I completely understand that. Well, I can understand to the best of my ability the predicament one might be in terms of being pulled a number of directions and kind of feeling some sort of, you know, social and ethical responsibility to do things a certain way. But I completely honor and respect that choice. And I think that's a really, it's a really great thing to be thinking about.
Well, and I mean, I think it itself is a sort of political or feminist choice to, you know, to keep doing the work that you're doing and, you know, not have to make the work be about being a woman, just to be a woman in the field.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything else you'd like to mention about the caucus itself or kind of its how it went or future plans?
I'll just mention that if you're interested, our meetings, every PSA meeting are open to allies. We welcome allies. And we have a listserv that is also open to allies that is at PSA Women's Caucus. I'm not going to be able to remember the address for it, but maybe you can chop it in later.
Yeah.
If I send it to you. But folks are welcome to join the listserv.
Okay. And how could allies be of best support of the Women's Caucus?
Oh, that's a good question. One of the cool things that we got to do for the 2018 PSA meeting was create these bystander intervention training tips, and it's a tip sheet that went out in everyone's registration packet, and the idea behind them is to point out that, you know, it's a sort of like TSA story of if you see something, say something, and figuring out how to effectively address issues of gender equity. So the bystander intervention training cards are about harassment specifically, gender harassment, other forms of harassment that can and do still happen at our meetings. Figuring out how you will handle those sorts of situations before you get into those situations is an important part of being a person, especially being an ally. And, you know, taking the time to think about how you can help when you see conflict, especially based around gender and ethnicity, which are sort of the most common ones that we have in our discipline. But, you know, more generally, looking around and taking time to become aware of how your particular department, your particular community, whatever you identify your community as, how it is interacting with, how it is supporting or failing to support the women and the other minorities who are part of that community, which can take the form of asking people about it. I hesitate to encourage people to just like walk up to them and be like, so how is it to be a woman in philosophy of science today? Because that itself is a kind of intellectual and emotional labor that you're asking someone to do for you. I don't know what the one best thing an ally could do is, but learning what it is to be an ally, spending a little bit of time on, you know, on Google, on, you know, just figuring out what allies are and how allies are supposed to work.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Can make a big difference. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks. And I really appreciate you bringing that up. My apologies again for not addressing it earlier in our interview, but I'm really glad to hear a little bit about it. And I wish you the best on in the future. And your connection with the PSA. So I imagine over the next couple of years, you'll be so you're involved with the Philosophy of Science Association over the next years or so, correct?
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. All right. Well, Julia, it's been a pleasure getting to chat, to learn a little bit about your origin story, your research in philosophy of nanoscience, philosophy of physics. Best of luck in this term. Are you, what are you currently teaching, by the way?
I'm teaching healthcare ethics and philosophy of science. So,
nice.
Straight down the middle of the road.
Okay.
Stuff that I really like, that I'm used to, that I've done before. Which is great because it's going to give me more time to get a little research done, organize this conference. And also my husband and I are trying to qualify for powerlifting nationals this year. So
really?
A little bit more time at the gym too.
Yeah. You guys do like CrossFit or other kind of powerlifting or?
No. So powerlifting is its own thing. CrossFit is very different. Powerlifting is a competitive weightlifting sport that involves three lifts, the squat, the bench press, and the deadlift.
Yep.
And my husband's been doing it for 14 years or so now. He's been doing it for a really long time. I started doing it right around the time I was writing my dissertation, and it was really helpful for dissertation steam. It's something that we do a lot together that is, I've been off cycle with it for about a year and looking forward to getting to it.
That's super fun. Well, if you're ever coming through Bloomington, there's a gym that myself, my wife and some of my friends go to. It's called the Iron Pit, and they have a great powerlifting program there. And I'm super familiar with that kind of thing. But I just wasn't sure. I know some people do lifts in CrossFit and outside of that. But
we are snobs. We look down on the CrossFit people.
I'm not going to say anything, but I kind of... Yeah, anyway. I hear you.
Don't put that in there.
It's okay.
It's fine.
It's okay. I think there's this healthy, fun competition between those who are in the exercise realm of things who... do CrossFit or who don't do CrossFit, and there's just it's a healthy competition, and throwing shade is fine.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, have a good rest of your day. It was great chatting with you. I would love to chat more. I unfortunately actually have to go teach a class at 1 o'clock, so I have to do some course prep. But anyway, enjoy the day, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Sounds good. Talk soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.